thanks for selling your car to Carvana. Here's your check.
Whoa, when did I get here?
What do you mean?
I swear it was just moments ago that I accepted a great offer from Carvana online. I must have time traveled to the future.
It was just moments ago. We do same day pickup. Here's your check for that great offer.
It is the future.
It's the present and just the convenience of Carvana. Sorry to blow your mind.
It's all good. Happens all the time.
Sell your car the convenient way to
Carvana.
Pickup times may vary and fees may apply.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Anna Colton, a clinical psychologist and eating disorder specialist, passionate about helping families build healthy relationships with food and their bodies. Alongside supporting individuals in recovery, Anna works with parents, especially those still healing, to prevent passing on food and body image struggles to the next generation. She's the author of How to Talk to Children About Food, recently featured in The Times and ITV's This Morning. It was a real pleasure to speak to Anna about this topic, as I think that so many of us, including myself, often worry about the messages around food and body and if we're going to pass them on to our children. So if you are currently navigating your own issues and you've got a little person in your life, I honestly recommend listening to this episode to get some insight and to know that you're not alone in having these fears.
Anna, it's so lovely to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
How are you doing today?
Good, thank you. Yeah, really well. You?
Good. I'm good, other than the fact that it's rained all day. And I feel like I'm such a negative Nancy because I was complaining before that it was too hot. Now I'm complaining that it's raining.
That's so British.
It's just so British.
That's so on brand.
Absolutely. I feel like you're not British if you're not moaning about the weather.
The weather.
Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, thank you. So I am Dr. Anna Colton. I'm a clinical psychologist and I have specialised, oh my goodness, since I was an assistant psychologist, so like forever, in eating disorders and anorexia within eating disorders. And fundamentally, I've always been an adolescent and eating disorder psychologist. The book that I've written that people see on my socials and that my socials are about comes from that, but it's called How to Talk to Children About Food. And instead of just writing, you know, a treatment book for anorexia or a treatment book for bulimia, or here's how you manage ARFID, or here's how you overcome picky eating, I wanted to write something much broader because in over 20 years in this field, you know, there's always a conversation with parents of what are the narratives at home around food? What is your history? What is your legacy? What do you bring into the family? What do the kids grow up watching? Let's think about all of that. So although I'm an adolescent person fundamentally, and nowadays a bit of adult as well, actually the book is probably aimed at the full from birth all the way through to adulthood.
I think that's incredible. And I think it's something I know personally myself, you know, I've been influenced by my parents and their messaging around food and body, and that's impacted me. But in a similar vein, for me, the thought of having children, I think genuinely my biggest concern is passing on the insecurities or the behaviours I have to my children. And so I think having your book as that resource sounds incredible to be able to explore your own relationship with food, to basically then be able to support your children in developing their relationship with food and body.
Absolutely. And you know, we can't, this is not me being a negative Nancy, we can't prevent every eating disorder. That's not possible. They're multifactorial, they're complex, they're biological, they're psychological, they're environmental, there's trauma involved in many of them. We can't prevent all of it, but we can prevent a whole load more than we currently are. And we can't prevent without looking at our own relationship. We can't prevent without understanding the society we live in. We can't prevent without understanding our own relationship with food and our spouse or our partner and everything that's being talked about everywhere. So we have to take a much broader view if we're going to even have a shot at it.
Yeah. And I kind of want to ask you more about how you work with clients, or maybe the information that's in your book. Where do you even start with people when they come to you and say, I want to work on my relationship with food and body?
It's going to sound so boring and so clinical. So partly, genuinely, it depends if people are poorly. You know, if someone comes in and they are in the middle of really quite serious bulimia or anorexia or very disordered eating, whether or not it meets diagnostic criteria, we have to address risk as number one, right? And we have to think about that as number one. But then it's an assessment. So tell me, what was childhood like? You know, what were the influences around you? And it's about curiosity at the beginning, being just super curious, not assuming, you know, I know anything, not assuming I understand anything. So there's always another question that I can ask that will help me kind of go, oh, that's really interesting. You know, you grew up in an environment where X happened or where Y happened. What was that like for you? What did you understand by that? What did you learn from that? What then happened next when you hit puberty? How was that handled? Because puberty also is a really tricky time. You know, if you're a girl in particular, you know, you have to gain both weight and fat to be able to have periods. That's not really known terribly well. And it can be really tricky. And if parents worry about that, if they don't know and they think it's scary or distressing or something's wrong, the messages that are given are damaging. So then we look at that and responses to any kind of difficulties, what the emotional vocabulary was like. So genuinely, there's so much to ask about, to think about, to learn about, to really understand. And then as we go through all that, you know, we'll have a conversation. Gosh, that must have been, you know, really tricky. So what did you understand when dad said X or your mum did Y or your grandma commented on everyone who was overweight in the street, which is very common, you know, or you were rewarded with food or there was no physical nurture and you just, you know, hit the chocolate from a really young age. What's the wiring in your brain? What did you learn emotionally? What did you learn, you know, rationally? And how has that evolved? And so it's often a long piece of work or a longer piece of work. And I tend to prepare people for that. You know, this is not something that you can do in six sessions and be done. It's a lifetime.
Yeah. What you've just spoken about there, I think, is really interesting because I think so often those kind of messages and behaviours that we've grown up with, they then become part of your normal life, or they become a belief that you have in your head that you don't necessarily even question because it's so ingrained.
Right.
And the work that then takes to realise that you're having those thoughts or those internalised biases and then unpick them and think about how they make you feel, and then think, well, do I want to still believe? Is that true? How do I want to shift that mentality? It is a big piece of work, isn't it?
It's a big piece of work. And I think it also often contains a lot of fear because people might want to unpick it. They might not enjoy feeling how they feel or believing what they believe, but oh my goodness, what will life be like? What will happen to me if I don't hang on to that belief anymore? What will happen to me if I start to believe that no food is bad, for example, that there is no such thing as bad food and there is no such thing as good food? Am I just going to suddenly find myself, you know, morbidly obese and that's a fear for me? Or am I going to find myself uncontrollably binging because I don't have the structure around what I eat and I don't have the kind of rules to live by? But what does it also mean if these messages I got from when I was young, from the people I trusted most, actually weren't helpful at all? How do I come to terms with that? How do I challenge that? How do I stay close and loving with this family? And alongside that, reject quite a lot of what was in my upbringing. These aren't easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's one thing for myself in recovery has been difficult, is kind of addressing those beliefs and then having those conversations with the people that held those beliefs. And sometimes you can't have those conversations. Mm. You know, you just mentioned there about it's quite common that grandmas will comment. And yes, I can relate to that very much so.
But likewise.
Yeah, where I felt that I could sit down with my mum and have a conversation with her and talk about those things, I couldn't with my grandma. because it didn't feel that we had the relationship. I didn't think that she'd be as open. And so for me, a lot of that work was learning how I respond in those situations rather than expecting necessarily other people to change their minds as well.
Absolutely. I mean, that's hit the nail on the head there, because we can't expect everyone else to change along with us. There's a huge amount of acceptance that comes in the work of yourself, of other people, of parents, of grandparents, of friends, of teachers, whoever it is. You know, well, I can't change them. So if I want to have a relationship with them, I have to accept these things and find a way internally to cope with some of the messaging that keeps coming and cope with the distress that I was done a disservice.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it can be upsetting when you realize sort of all the messages that you've internalized. And I think one thing I find very tricky is that, you know, not all of them, do they come from your family environment or have you? It's social media, it's the media. I mean, you know, when I was little, it was television and films, and now with social media, I think it's a whole other kettle of fish.
I mean, it is, you know, that's diet culture, isn't it? And it is, in my view, the predominant culture in which we live. You know, it's everywhere, it's every message. It's now in schools where the teaching around healthy eating, which I put in inverted commas because it's not really a phrase that I like, but around healthy eating is done often by asking kids to come home, look in their cupboards and traffic light the foods, look at the back of packets. It's harm, but I understand it's come from a governmental level. I kind of understand it's come from a fear about rising obesity and how to tackle that, but that is not the way to tackle it. And it's going to do more harm, because kids come home and then they're confused and then they don't know who to trust. Do I trust mummy's food? Do I trust school? I don't understand. Why does she have bad food? Why do we have bad food in the cupboards at home? It's not, I mustn't eat it. That's starting at 4 and 5. Well, that is not prevention. That is setting kids up for disordered eating and difficult relationship with food. And that's what we're living in. And that's before we talk about, you know, social media and GLP-1s and everything else that's currently happening. And we had made huge progress, but it feels like we've taken a step back.
Yeah, I think undoubtedly over the past year, 6 months, it feels like a massive step back. But just before we go on to that, I want to ask you, because my I don't have children, my jaw dropped when you said about coming home and traffic lighting food. What would you say is a better approach to that, rather than scaremongering with good and bad and all of that?
Well, it's so interesting you ask, because, you know, I've written the book, I have the conversations, and, you know, truth be told, I too sometimes go, what do we do? And I do use some of the language that I advocate against. Sometimes I go, oh God, it came out of my mouth of all people's, you know, oops. And I try and repair that. But I think nutrition education, which is what we're really talking about, needs to be literally that nutrition education, really specific, age appropriate and accurate. Because what does it mean when we use language like healthy? What does a child understand by that? What does an adult understand by that? We understand it through the lens that we see the world. But you know, what is healthy? Actually, it's code for good. It's code for foods that are nutritious for sure, but also that are going to have an impact on weight and shape in a way that people want. And unhealthy is code for bad, which is why I don't really like it. You know, So what is in this food? Why do we have lots and lots of different coloured vegetables? That's so fascinating. What's in a purple cap? What's in a red cabbage, which is purple, obviously? You know, what's in that? Why is it purple? And what's in beetroot? And what's in carrots? And what's in lettuce? Why are they different colours? Let's be curious about that. Oh, wow, all the different minerals and vitamins we get from all the different colours of food. And we need that full range to make us, you know, grow and be healthy, which is be well. As people, we need a whole range. So very specific, age appropriate, interesting kind of education would be my preference. You know, all sorts of things like you wash red cabbage, one of my favourite ones. You wash red cabbage, the water turns blue. I mean, like that's I still find that cool. And then you squeeze in some lemon juice and the water turns pink. That is more interesting in terms of teaching and experiments and kind of remembering something than coming home and traffic lighting what's on the back of packets.
Yeah. I can attest to the blue situation with the cabbage, because I tried to make, well, I did make a pickled cabbage, and I came home one day and I was like, why is there blue splashes all up the wall? And that was from me making pickled cabbage.
That's genius.
So I can attest to that. And that's, as you say, that's so much more fun. The colours of the food that you're eating and learning about that and learning about the benefits of them, rather than thinking about calories and weight and all that scaremongering information. And I've been reading a book lately called Lobster, and it's basically, I can't remember, it's Holly somebody, and absolutely love the book because she's basically just like taken things that we've come to accept in society, and she's basically saying like, why have we accepted this? And one of them is talking about the best age to be as a toddler, because they just love life and they love playing in puddles and they love the simple things. And she was saying how, you know, and I'm not shaming sugary foods here, because I think that they can be part of the diet and, you know, we can all enjoy them. But she was saying that kids absolutely love fruit until we introduce them to sweets and stuff. And then obviously they're then more kind of attracted to the sweets and stuff. And again, I'm not saying that that's bad, just that, you know, innately children love those sorts of foods and are so interested in having fun with their food. And that's ultimately what food should be about. It should be enjoyment.
Exactly.
But diet culture has just absolutely slashed any enjoyment we can feel.
Oh my God. It's like, for any, you know, I don't know if you're a Harry Potter person, but I feel like diet culture is a dementor. You know,
absolutely. It
just sucks the life, the joy, the anything out of food. Mm-hmm. But, you know,
finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
If you sit down with children at school and you let's say you have a Granny Smith and a Red Delicious and a Pink Apple, they all taste really different. Mm. Try the apples. Be curious about the taste. Great. Yeah, so that's easy. And yes, as they get older, but you know, the other thing about all of this is that a 4 and a 5-year-old should not be made to feel responsible for any choice around the food that they're given to eat. It's not their responsibility. Their cognitive development isn't advanced enough to make those decisions, to make those choices, or to carry that responsibility. It's completely age inappropriate. It is too demanding. It is, frankly, wrong. So don't do that. Just don't set them up for that. Yeah, that comes much, much later. And so as kids get older, all the way up, you add a little bit more detail and a little bit more nuance. You know, when it comes to ultra processed foods, which a lot of people now are very, very stressed by, you know, you can think about what goes in them, what makes them, you know, what makes the taste that they create? What is it in there that makes you want more and more and more? Potentially. Why does it not keep you so full? Really good conversations, really helpful. Mm-hmm. Crap and junk, they don't give you any information. There's literally no learning there. So I can rant about any of this all day long. Yes. It'll be very boring. So I won't do it. But it's not thoughtful. It's not a thoughtful approach. It's an approach based on fear. And if we teach kids about food, if we talk to teens about food and eating and bodies, through a lens of fear, it causes harm.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I really like what you said there about, you know, with ultra processed foods and asking deeper questions and things like that. I mean, personally, I don't think that we can just like label them as bad completely, because brown rice is an ultra processed food. And, you know, that's still something that, you know, arguably would be seen as an extremely healthy food. So I think there's got to be hummus, that's a great one. Yeah.
You know?
There's got to be
nuance
with it rather than just like black and white thinking. But unfortunately, I do think that is what diet culture does. It's black and white, all or nothing, good and bad. What I want to ask you is, you know, I think that great advice there about speaking to children and having those conversations and opening up those conversations as well. Because I think the more that you say you open up those conversations, if they then hear something, they then feel, you know, we have conversations about food at home, I can ask about that now. And you're creating that space. As someone that is an adult, and has been brainwashed. I'm going to say brainwashed because I feel like it is, with lots of messages about food and body. How can we start to change our relationship with food and body to then help the younger generation? Because I can completely see that we should be having those conversations, but I think it's so hard to have them when you don't maybe believe them because of what you've been told.
Yes, and are continuing to be told, because that's the problem, isn't it? The narrative isn't going to shift societally. The narrative at the moment is going backwards. It's not improving. So there is, you know, that is part of the self-work is, you know, you can say, look, I feel I was brainwashed. When your children are old enough, potentially, you can say, look, I was brainwashed by diet culture. And this is the damage it did. You know, I received all of these messages. And because, you know, there is a reality, isn't there? We don't want kids to live entirely on sugar. We don't want kids to live entirely on Pringles. These aren't good. You know, that is not a balanced diet. It's not ideal. It's not going to lead to, you know, proper long-term health. So I can get totally behind that, but it's how we do it. And it's about realizing that, you know, a bit of any of those things isn't a problem at all. It's about the approach of, you know, a bit of everything. That's what we want. So it's almost not engaging with the individual foods and looking at the overall plate. But even that, why do you need to do that if all is well? Actually, why do you need to do it? What you want to do with kids is model the relationship with food that you would like them to have. So if you were to have kids and you were to want them to eat a whole range of fruit and veg and, you know, grains and protein and hopefully, you know, some chocolate and cakes and crisps with a chilled attitude, for example, the most important thing is they see you doing exactly that. And sometimes you have to get there through behavior. You almost don't need, well, it's much easier if you believe, but if you don't believe, but are conscious that you don't believe and are conscious of what you'd like them to see, you can still show them. And you keep the comments for when they're out of earshot. And you're vigilant about what you express thought-wise. It's harder that way. But the more you expose yourself to the challenge, the more you surround yourself with people who do believe or who believe enough. You don't have to believe fully. You know, you don't have to believe fully, but you have to believe enough to actively want to make the change for your kids, to break that cycle, to not gift them your baggage.
And I imagine actually, and this is purely based on my own experience, that could actually be quite healing.
Healing.
When I was in recovery for my own eating disorder, at the start, I did not want to do it for me. And so I said I did it for my parents and my partner. And that is completely true. But one of the main reasons was I did it for my cats, because I know that sounds crazy.
I saw a post of yours, I remember your post on your cat. And I thought,
you probably did.
I do. I remember. I was like, yay, fellow cat person. You've got to love a fellow cat person, right? So
absolutely.
I was like, yay, fellow cat person. But I was also like, I am overjoyed to read the honesty of this post.
My cats are with me day in, day out, and they also rely on me to feed them, clean their litter box, all of these things. It felt for me as a way to be like, okay, I'm going to do this for the cats. Because I need to be well in order to look after them, in order to be a good mum to them. And so that was kind of my point relating back to the food stuff was, you know, sometimes you don't do it for yourself. You do it for other people or what have you. But that in a way can be almost, you give yourself acceptance because you're not doing it for yourself. If you've been in a place of quite a lot of, like, you know, low self-esteem or self-hatred, that sort of thing, to do it for others can feel like a really great first.
And actually, I think even more powerfully, you then don't have to own it in quite the same way. So that level of detachment of, this isn't actually for me, it's for my cats, or it's for my daughter, or it's for my son, or it's for my kids, whatever it may be, or it's like, it's not me challenging the eating disorder. And that can make it much easier to challenge, because it's so hard to stand up to. It's so hard to reject the kind of the voice in your head. I mean, I don't know why I'm telling you that. You totally know. But, you know, it's like, well, it's not me. I don't really believe this. But for these people, I have to do it. And it gives you that out that allows a bit more flexibility that then allows some recovery and some healing. And so it's amazing. And, you know, when you have a child, and it is dissimilar, of course, and it's not to an animal, but when you know, oh my God, that kind of primal urge to protect is there from the moment well, from the moment often you get pregnant, but certainly from the moment you have the child, that primal kind of, I have to keep this beautiful being safe and protected. And part of that comes from us. And so sometimes that is incredibly motivating.
I'm just playing devil's advocate, because that's what I like to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you worked with many people when they have fallen pregnant or had a baby that absolutely with their deepest heart want to recover or, you know, heal their relationship with food and body? But, you know, I'd love to think, and I always thought this myself, like, oh, I'll have a baby and I'll recover from my eating disorder. And then you get pregnant or what have you. Not that I've got pregnant, but like something happens and you go, oh, that wasn't the penny dropping that I needed. Kind of firstly, have you experienced that? And then how do you support people through that? Because I can imagine there's so much guilt of wanting to get better, but just not being able to let go.
Yes, it happens. It happens more than I think I'd like to accept, believe, although I do. But actually, if someone is engaged with me, that's half the battle won, however difficult it is. The difficulty comes when someone is not even there to recognize as a problem. And if you don't even recognize as a problem, if you don't even recognize you're at risk of passing on disordered eating or an eating disorder, you're destined to pass it on. So for as long as someone is engaged, I'm delighted, because they're coming back, we're having the conversations. That in itself is protective. Maybe not as protective as if they can combat it, but you can at least say, okay, so if you can't do this meal, who can do this meal for you? If you're really struggling, who can we pull in at that moment so you can just walk out and not pass it on in that moment, so that something different can be modelled? And the other way I look at it often is like an addiction and a kind of maintenance of sobriety. You know, when people recover from alcoholism or alcohol addiction, it doesn't mean they don't want to drink. There's a maintenance of sobriety. And sometimes it can be really helpful for people to see it through that lens, because it's easier. You can detach a little bit and you can say, okay, what does that look like today if I'm going to maintain it for this next meal? How do I do that? And so it gives a structure that may not otherwise be there otherwise.
I like that idea. I think that's brilliant. I mean, I've had conversations on the podcast before talking about, you know, the potential similarities and differences between an addiction and eating disorder. And, you know, I think that's a really good point that you said there. Just because somebody's sober doesn't mean that they don't want to have a drink or they don't want to use drugs. And I think using that analogy or that reference, I think it's people that haven't had an eating disorder find it so hard to comprehend. Like, why do you want to engage in that when it's hurting you so much? Yeah. When it's the only way you know that you have to cope, it's then very difficult to detach from. And then especially, I think, when children come into play and other people so that you might be affecting surrounding you, you do then, you know, you have that concern of how is this impacting them, and I don't want it to impact them. But I think, like you said, if there's that awareness, that is the biggest step.
That's the biggest piece. And if there's an awareness and a desire not to pass it on, I mean, literally that's two thirds of it sorted. You know, part of me, that is massive.
Part of me is thinking when somebody's struggling with an eating disorder, they may not be aware of how chronic their eating disorder is. But often there's an awareness that there's an issue and that somebody is poorly. But when someone's engaging in diet culture, from the outside, they may appear healthy, or they may appear kind of just, you know, devoted or what have you. But the behaviours are very rigid still. It's just not a diagnosable eating disorder. And so I think part of me feels like the disordered eating diet culture is potentially more dangerous because no one's questioning it's wrong.
I'm not sure that they can be totally separated out, though, because that disordered eating diet culture lays the foundation for eating disorders. It lays the foundation for kind of through FITSPO or through yet another plan, or just do this and you'll get your summer. I mean, I'm currently getting frustrated with all the kind of, are you hitting menopause? Are you gaining belly fat? And I'm like, geez, but this is the same thing again, wrapped up in menopause. You know, what is this? Why are we seeing this? I actually really don't like it. And I understand, you know, there are all sorts of changes hormonally in women's bodies, but it's just playing into it again. So I think it sets us up. I think it lays the foundation. I think, therefore, it is really dangerous. I think a lot of eating disorders are missed because they masquerade as willpower or lean, or a term I really loathe, clean eating, because I don't even understand what it means. you know, I totally understand what people mean by it, but like, is there dirty eating? What does that look like? What is this word clean? I think disordered eating and eating disorders masquerade sometimes and we miss them. And we know the problem with that is we know that the greatest and mainly actually not even the greatest, the only prognostic factor of any relevance is how quickly you get in there with treatment. Early intervention is the greatest prognostic factor after prevention, right? That's it. That's literally it. Readiness to change is quite high up, but actually it's how long has it been established? How entrenched is it? And so if it's been missed because no one's noticed or it's felt normal or it's been normalized, that is dangerous. The other thing to say is that I know we kind of often talk about eating disorders as you know, being diagnosable, but there are many people who may not tick every single criteria to get the eating disorder from the DSM-5 that we currently are using, which is the classification of mental disorder or, you know, psychiatric illness. You know, that just because you don't tick every criteria doesn't mean you don't have an eating disorder. You just don't tick all the boxes to give you one particular label. You can still have, you know, weight is a symptom of an eating disorder. It is not a cause, right? I wish more people knew that. Weight is a symptom. Whether it's underweight, overweight, doesn't really matter. It's a symptom. The weight is not the most important thing unless you're really at severe physical risk. Again, at either end of the spectrum, you know?
Yeah.
At either end.
Absolutely.
And the brain, and then with the restrictive eating disorders, you know, we know that intermittent fasting, which is a big thing now and has been for a few years, but we know that restriction leads to binging. So many people who try an intermittent fast, thinking it's healthy, will end up binging. It's not the way forward. Now, some people find it really useful, and I'm not going to diss it from that perspective. You know, there is a lot of research that in the reversal of type 2 diabetes, intermittent fasting can be very effective. Great. That's a medical thing, medical intervention for a medical condition. But fasting restriction leads to binging. It also, if you don't end up binging, your brain changes really quickly with restriction and you get starvation cognitions, you get starvation emotions, and they're not yours really. And the only way out is to eat again and regain the weight. So it's a very, very difficult spiral to break once you're in. And it happens within 10 days, 2 weeks, sometimes quicker. The biology changes, your neurobiology changes. I mean, it's just not worth it. But it's so normalized that a lot of people walk around with what we might call subclinical eating disorders.
Yeah. And that was basically the point I was trying to make earlier, but I was just getting my points of where I was trying to combine them confused. Was saying how dangerous the normalization of dieting and sorts of behaviors are in the development of eating disorders. Because I think, you know, like you've said, there are so many behaviors now that are just completely normalized, glorified, absolutely desired. And it's quite terrifying, I think, the measures people are willing to take in order to lose weight or, you know, whatever kind of goal somebody has. But the more that the behaviors are coming out, like fasting, GLP-1 medication, you know, the list goes on. I just worry so much for the younger generation in terms of, you know, you said earlier about when you're a parent and telling your child, you know, I was victim of the culture that existed. I remember my mum telling me that she used to use like the Weight Watcher toffees and stuff, thinking that they were toffees, but realised they were laxatives. And so then, you know, really wanted to, she was then using them to lose weight and stuff like that. She was only 10 years old, and you cannot blame her for that. And then for internalising that messaging, because that's what was present. And I think that's the thing I worry about. I felt like we were getting to a really good place in society of being able to call out these behaviours. And then now that GLP-1s have just landed on the market and absolutely just blown up, I feel like we've gone back to square one. It's shocking how quickly we've reversed back.
It is horrendous how quickly we've gone back. And the thing is, again, I don't have a problem with GLP-1s as a tool in a toolbox for treatment of a medical condition when you meet nice criteria. Yeah. Right. Great. They're amazing. Great. Use them. They're great. But they should be a part of a package, a holistic package with dietetic support, psychological support, you know, exercise and lifestyle support. They should be a tool in a package and they should be properly regulated. I mean, that really is you'll get me really on my soapbox about the lack of regulation on the GLP-1s. And I think that's actually the problem, is the lack of regulation. It's not actually their existence. It's that they should be regulated like, you know, other, you know, very powerful, potent medications that have to be prescription only, have to be monitored, You know, you can't just get through uploading a form, et cetera, et cetera. You shouldn't be able to buy them. They should be regulated. And that's where the problem with GLP-1s, I think, comes, is in poor regulation.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think I could probably do a whole podcast series, let alone a podcast episode about GLP-1s. And
did you see the This Morning interview? I'm not sure if it was last week or this week. 11-year-old girl on Ozempic. I mean, that's before puberty. That's before periods. That's interfering with pubertal development. It is an absolute travesty.
I think that actually really nicely ties into the conversation we're having. Because when I first heard about that, I was like, oh my God, how could a parent allow their child to go on those medications? But when you take a step back and think about it, the level of fear that that parent must have felt in terms of their child, I'm using air quotes here, being fat, and then the concerns about bullying, the concerns about potential health concerns that they will have had because of what they will have heard in the media, to do that and put your child on that medication, I think that just to me shows how completely warped society is to think weight loss at any cost.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. Obviously, that is terrifying to me. You know, it wasn't the UK, thank goodness, but we'll go there. Unless there's a proper shift. And you're interfering with, you know, just as they hit puberty, just as their brain starts to rewire in adolescence, which is already an incredibly tricky, amazing, extraordinary decade of neurological rewiring and change, you're interfering.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Anna, thank you so much for chatting to me today. You've provided so much insight, and I know that this episode is going to be so useful for people that are navigating these concerns, which I can imagine is a lot of people at the moment. Where can people go to find out more about you?
So I have a website, which is just www.dranna.co.uk. But then I'm on Instagram, TikTok, LinkedIn, and my book is on Amazon, How to Talk to Children About Food, and elsewhere too. So I think I'm really quite findable.
You are very findable. Yes, I'm very impressed. And I'll put that all in the show notes. But honestly, it's been such a pleasure to chat to you. So thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me. Loved it.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together, because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.